Thank you, choir. As I've already said to Barb, a wonderful director, that I'm happy to have you sing anytime, but what you sang fits in with what I'm hoping to say today. Welcome, good morning, all those things. This is, as I think most of you know, Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society, so if you're in the wrong place, just stay, you'll like it. Prairie attempts to be a welcoming and open-minded place. We welcome you no matter where you are on the spiritual journey, the sacred journey, the journey of life, no matter your gender identification, your ethnicity, color of your skin, your physical abilities or disabilities, your family structure, you are welcome here. If this is one of your first times, I always encourage people to come more than once because our services can be very different. Sometimes I do them. I am Sandy Ingham, Prairie's consulting minister. Sometimes people from within the congregation do the service, and often we have people from outside this particular community. I don't know if we have any guests or visitors or fairly new people, but there will be a time later on when you will be invited, hopefully not coerced, to introduce yourselves. Can this be possible? There's only really one announcement because we are trying to incorporate the second announcement into part of our little welcoming speech, and that is to remind you that we are now giving part of our offering to various organizations. And this month of April, we are sharing our offering with The Road Home. So I encourage you to put lots of money in that offering basket. Don't let it get to the back row empty. It's embarrassing. The Road Home is inscribed in your order of service. Remembered it this time. The opening words are by Unitarian Universalist Minister Ann Pert. We come together to celebrate who we are, to share the insights that give meaning and hope to our lives, to learn from the wisdom of others that their truths may contribute to our understanding. We light our flaming chalice to illuminate the world we seek. In the search for truth, may we be just. In the search for justice, may we be loving, and in loving, may we find peace. Of course, I have to tell you a short story before we do joys and concerns. I got these with my sister and my mother, who was then probably in her late 70s. My mother tap danced almost till the day she died. She was a really good tap dancer. But as her very short term memory went, she found she was writing the steps in her palm, trying to. But as she said to me, the only problem with that was I was always at least a half a beat behind because I had to read my hand. This reading is from a book called The Glass Cage by Nicholas Carr. Writes, I was in a fix. I had, by necessity, not choice, struck up an alliance with a demented grave robber named Seth Briers. I don't eat, I don't sleep, I don't wash, and I don't care, Seth had informed me, not without a measure of pride, shortly after we met in the cemetery beside Coots Chapel. He knew the whereabouts of certain individuals I was seeking, and in exchange for leading me to them, he had demanded that I help him cart a load of fresh corpses out past Critchley's ranch to a dusty ghost town called Tumbleweed. I drove Seth's horse-drawn wagon, while he stayed in the back, rifling the dead for valuables. The trip was a trial. We made it through an ambush by highwaymen along the route. With firearms, I was more than handy. But when I tried to cross a rickety bridge near Gaptooth Ridge, the weight of the body shifted, and I lost control of the horses. The wagon careened into a ravine, and I died in a volcanic screen-coating eruption of blood. You're catching on now, right? I came back to life after a couple of purgatorial seconds, only to go through the ordeal again. After a half dozen failed attempts, I began to despair of ever completing the mission. The game I was playing, an exquisitely crafted, goofily written open world shooter called Red Dead Redemption, is set in the early years of the last century, so early 1900s, in a mythical southwestern border territory named New Austin. Its plot is pure Peckinpah. You won't all recognize that name. It's Sam Peckinpah, a movie director, producer also maybe. When you start the game, you assume the role of a stoic outlaw turned rancher named John Marston, whose right cheek is riven by a couple of long, symbolically deep scars. Marston is being blackmailed into tracking down his old criminal associates by federal agents who are holding his wife and young son hostage. To complete the game, you have to guide the gunslinger through various feats of skill and cunning, each a little tougher than the one preceding it. After a few more tries, I finally did make it over that bridge, grisly cargo in tow. In fact, after many mayhem-filled hours in front of my Xbox-connected flat-screen TV, I managed to get through all of the game's 50-odd missions. As my reward, I got to watch myself, John Marston, that is, be gunned down by the very agents who had forced him into the quest. Gruesome ending aside, I came away from the game with a feeling of accomplishment. Video games, Carr says, tend to be loathed by people who have never played them. I've never played a video game. That's understandable given the gore involved, but it's a shame because, among other things, the best games provide a model for the design of software. They show how applications can encourage the development of skills rather than their atrophy. And then he goes on to talk about how good you can feel, at least in a mental sense. You certainly don't involve your whole self in video games. But anyway, okay. Nicholas Carr's point here is not really about video games. He is using his experience playing this particular game to illustrate how thinking and being challenged has evolved or shifted in the computer digital internet age, shifted from people needing to use their brains when interacting with computers to giving over a lot of our brain power to computers and letting them do more and more of our thinking. Maybe there was a time when we could make a case that using computers to play video games could, maybe even would, give you a sense of accomplishment. But Carr argues, and others argue, that that is not the norm for current computer technology. And I am glad to see some of our computer people here today. I thought you might have all gone to the Humane Society, but here you are. Current computer technology leads us to miswanting, a false sense of what we want, of what would make our lives easier. I consider this to be a form of brainwashing. We think that we must have the latest electronic devices to make our lives better and easier. But is that what they do? But surely more automation, more apps, more devices with screens must be a good thing, right? Letting computers do more and more will, at least theoretically, give us humans more leisure time, right? Then why is everyone so busy? And I don't have time to get into what automation has done to skilled labor and to job losses. Carr is also trying to make a larger point here, and throughout his book, The Glass Cage, How Our Computers Are Changing Us, as he puts it, ours may be a time of material comfort and technological wonder, but it's also a time of aimlessness and gloom. Is there a connection here to what Carr calls our pursuit of a frictionless existence? If the ground of our being is looking at screens and being unchallenged as whole beings, unchallenged by anything else, where does that put us humans? Possibly in a barren, blah, even conforming place. A few days ago in a coffee shop, as I was waiting to get the half and half that I have to have in my coffee, the woman in front of me seemed extra slow, but I was practicing being patient until I realized that she was glued to her smartphone screen. She was texting while trying to doctor her coffee. And she, I mean, you know, it's one thing to sit in a coffee shop and text, but, and she continued to text while trying to stir that hot coffee, put a little more sugar in it, and maybe move out of the line. She was totally oblivious to her surroundings. And this was not a young woman. We cannot blame this on the younger generations. I have read that people who design software have often been taught or advised to stay away from challenging humans the way that they were challenged by early video games. And maybe we still are challenged by video games, because I know nothing about video games. A respected software design consultant, someone named Peter Merholz, urges programmers to aim for frictionlessness and simplicity when designing their products. That's not all bad. But what does it mean, really mean? Among other things, it means that we depend less and less upon our own amazing complex brains, and that certain functions in these brains might be getting rusty, even to the point of atrophying. I don't say this word out loud. Atrophying. Atrophication? Is that a word? Anyway, we don't want them to atrophy. Okay. The last Sunday in January, I talked about what turned out to be part one on this subject. What effect will looking at screens have on humans in the long run? Now, it's not quite that simple. I realized that I was talking about more than just looking at screens, computer and television screens, as well as all the newer devices with screens that we have and that take up what I believe is an inordinate amount of our time. It's not just the fact of spending so much time staring at screens that concerns me. Automation scares me. Apps scare me. Not because I don't know how to use them. Just the idea of, never mind. Siri frightens me. Not the fact of Siri, but the perceived need for Siri is what frightens me. I don't see the point. The necessity of having my questions answered instantly, even my rhetorical ones, or my life being that automated. Although if Cookie Monster comes with Siri, I might consider purchasing the system. Anybody know what I'm talking about? Apparently I watch too much television. There is a wonderful ad for Siri featuring Cookie Monster. And I don't care what Cookie Monster's doing, he cracks me up. So I watch it and watch it. What will happen to memory, imagination, creativity if everything is programmed for us? What will happen to human connection, to community, to fellowship, to storytelling, to learning in a deep, meaningful way about other cultures, other ways of being, as we become more and more dependent on technology to figure out everything for us? Will robots eventually take over. Now, that used to sound like an odd or even a ridiculous question, but I think it's pretty relevant and critical that we ask this. As I questioned in January, who will program the robot's conscience, assuming a robot would even have a conscience? The robot's manufacturer, its owner, software coders, politicians, government regulators, philosophers, insurance companies. Here are two caveats before I continue. Caveat means an explanation to prevent misinterpretation. Try to remember that. One, it is way too early to know what effect all of this will have on our brains and the wiring of our brains in the long range, you know, long term. Obviously, not enough time has gone by yet to do long-range studies that would be meaningful. There are early findings, though, from more than one source that indicate there might be a connection between using computers to think for us and early onset Alzheimer's. And my second caveat is I'm biased against too much screen time. I am not objective about this, but you probably already figured that out. Nevertheless, my reflections this morning are not intended, believe it or not, to be a rant against all technology. I'm not, or all technology in general, or computers and electronic devices in particular, I'm not advocating a return to living in caves or giving up every modern convenience. I don't want to live without electricity, especially when there's a blizzard 1 minute and, you know, sunshine the next. And I want some computer technology to be frictionless and simple. I don't need to know everything about the inner workings of my digital clock if I want to set the alarm on that clock, although some that I've had, that seems like I need to know that. There are two important questions to be asked as we contemplate all of this. First, we should always carefully consider this. To what end will new technology be used? Now, obviously, we can't know all the ways that a new technology will be used, but that's one important question. The second question is, what do these two words mean? Human being. What does it mean to be human? As journalist Nicholas Carr says, technology has always challenged people to think about what's important in their lives, to ask themselves what human being means, but automation raises the stakes. To resist invention does not mean we reject invention. It's to humble invention, to bring progress down to earth. Technology initially was not thought of as a bad thing. In fact, it was supposed to be a force not only for the improvement of daily living, but also as a means of political reform. Right. But now we should ask this question too. Have we gotten to a place where we too often develop technology for the sake of developing technology? In other words, because we can. And there is the profit motive too. I'll mention that in a few minutes. Who needs humans anyway? Why not just take us out of the picture completely? We need to let robots take over, said Kevin Kelly, a technology theorist, in a cover story in a 2013 edition of Wired. Consider aviation. Why even bother to have a pilot there? Well, if you were here when I did part one, I gave you several examples of the value of having a real-life person in the cockpit who might know how to fly and land a plane. A person who's paying attention, that is. And I mentioned then that I took flying. I took ground school. I did quite well. I know how to take off, but I never learned how to land, which we would all agree is important, probably. But the one thing I really learned that was really drummed into us in ground school was the importance of redundancy. You cannot depend on the airplane's instruments to do everything. Talking about the mess, and I think it is a mess, of the public schools in Chicago, Someone said, only partly in jest, why not forget teachers and issue all 404,151 students an iPad or an Android tablet? And what about computerizing tasks in hospitals? Some hospitals use computers a lot, but some of them use computers to dispensing of drugs, but the breaking down of the drug inventory and everything. But what happens when the technology breaks down? What happens when whatever's wrong with you doesn't fit whatever's in that computer? Do you want Dr. Algorithm or do you want Dr. Human? Ours is a world of interdependent networks, a group of physicists wrote in Nature magazine in 2010. And they went on to note that our critical infrastructures in this country, water, transportation, fuel, power stations, are linked through electronic and other means, which makes them extremely sensitive to random failure. A Google executive named Alan Eagle said in 2011, "We make technology as brain-dead easy to use as possible." In response, Nicholas Carr wonders, where is human talent in that kind of mindset? How does it, or can it, compete with what a Google executive wants? The prospect of saving time and money, making money. Parasuraman, a psychology professor at George Mason University and one of the world's leading authorities on automation, was asked if he thought society was capable of using automation more wisely in the future in an attempt to get a better balance between technology-centered automation and human-centered automation. Parasuraman's response was, "I'm not very optimistic." And that was a couple of years ago. Ray Kurzweil, an inventor and a futurist and Google's director of engineering in 2012, I don't know if he still is, said in the context of talking about the evolution of Google's search engine from something that the user actually participated in to where that search engine process seems to be headed now, a place where we won't have to put much mental effort into our searches. Kurzweil says this about Google's progress in this area, if indeed it is progress. "I envision some years from now that the majority of search queries will be answered without you actually asking. The company will just know that this is something you're going to want to see." Well, I find that way of thinking scary. Let's just fully automate the search process and take human will right out of the picture. I'm envisioning a lot of librarians spinning in a lot of graves. Carr maintains that with social networks such as Facebook, we no longer need to be concerned with the time-consuming aspects of personal relations. The messy process of figuring out how to affiliate with others, the conscious effort of socializing, it's all done for you. It's all automated. And Mark Zuckerberg loves it. He's been quoted as celebrating all of this Facebook stuff as frictionless sharing. Well, he wants everyone to use Facebook. Of course he does. How much money has he made and is still making just with this sophisticated toy for communicating? But why would we want to, in Carr's words, use bureaucratic ideals of speed, productivity, and standardization in our relationships with other people? Follow the money. Some of you may remember who said that. Well, probably lots of people said that, but Molly Ivins popularized it. Follow the money, because the profit motive has a great deal to do with automation. Getting to know others, making friends, is often not efficient or convenient, not by market standards anyway, but which is more fulfilling? Carr refers to Facebook and other places as meddlesome parents who demean and diminish our character qualities such as ingenuity, curiosity, independence, perseverance, daring. Well, life is messy. And I don't think that's a bad thing. What kind of a world would it be if everything were black and white, which is what automation aims for? Take away the gray areas, solve the world's problems with better and better, more and more efficient software. Take the guesswork out of, well, just about everything. Some of you will recognize the name David Brooks. He's a New York Times writer, and he's often on PBS. He tells a wonderful story about falling in love with his GPS and that voice, that seductive voice, and how eventually he fell out of love because he realized he was using it for everything. I mean, just to go not very far, even to get to places they knew how to get to. Then there's a place for GPS and MapQuest and things like that. But when it becomes your only way of getting around, something is lost. And then there are numerous stories of people in different professions, like architecture and photography, who started out being really excited by computer use to do a lot of the work of architecture and photography, and eventually stopped. At least they stopped using it in the architect's case. They stopped using anything automated, any software in the initial part. They would of their trying to design things because it just limited them too much. One of the photographers who was interviewed said, "Yeah, I was really excited about digital cameras and everything, and I thought I was giving up my tripod and the use of film and all." And then he said he realized that it was what he was getting from the digitized versions was cold, and he didn't put enough time in it, even though he could pick and choose, you know, from hundreds of different digitized photos. At the top of your order of service, oh, and it's important to note, too, that the people that I just talked about, David Brooks, photographer and architect, these aren't people who hate computers, not at all. They were practicing discernment. So I'll say more about that in just a minute. But the quote at the top of your order of service: "In the future, people will spend less time trying to get technology to work because it will just be seamless. It will just be there. The web will do everything. And it will also be nothing. It will be like electricity. If we get this right, I believe we can fix all the world's problems." Unfortunately, I couldn't find out when this was said. Well, I would say the jury is still out on that theory, that the web, the internet web, computers, but the web especially, can fix all the world's problems. I have many doubts about that. Without human input, though, without full use of humanity's skills and ideas, however bumbling and ineffective they may seem to be, without us, technology can't fix anything. And after all, you know, I'm not stating the obvious here. Who inputs the data? Who writes the software? Who programs the apps? Humans. I believe that there is a key word missing here. It rarely gets put into this discussion. It rarely gets put into the equation of what kind of automation will best serve humanity. And that word is discernment. And synonyms are perception, insight, acumen. It's a word you don't hear very often. The power to see what is not evident to the average mind. But discernment, recognizing, identifying what's separate, what's distinct, seeing and understanding differences. Well, in the meantime, as we are practicing discernment, those of us who call ourselves free thinkers, I think, should be very afraid of a world where computer use is seamless, that is so ubiquitous, so everywhere that we don't even realize that it's there. And we should be hyper-vigilant, very worried about automation. What will happen to the tap dancers of the world? To the poets, the sculptors, the writers, the drawers, the artists? Who will bother, in the words of William Blake, in that song we sang earlier, who will bother to see the world in a grain of sand and a heaven in a wildflower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, and eternity in an hour, Who will have time to do that? Or so much of our time is used as screen time. How many roads less traveled will we bother to take? Will humans in the future even be aware that there are roads less traveled to explore? Will the generations that come after us take the time and the effort to spend time outside and literally contemplate which path to travel? And just as important, after having chosen, literally and figuratively, which road to take, will our descendants take the time to tell the stories about their choices? To tell them not via social media, but face to face and in groups, actual living groups without electronic devices? Will we manage to find a balance between automation and all that makes us human? Imagination, curiosity, creativity. I am frightened for the human race. I'm frightened for a few other reasons too, but this morning I'm concentrating on this one. Perhaps I should have called these reflections "Which web?" When I talk about the great web, I mean the one that we refer to in our seventh principle, the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. Which web is more important? The worldwide internet web or the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part? I'm going to end my remarks with this poem by Denise Levertov titled "Web." Intricate and untraceable, weaving and interweaving, dark strand with light, designed beyond all spiderly contrivance to link, not to entrap, elation, grief, joy, contrition, entwined, shaking, changing, forever forming, transforming. All praise to the great web. Take courage, friends. The way is often hard. The path is never clear. And the stakes are very high. Take courage, for deep down there is another truth. You are not alone. Greet your neighbor, drink coffee, go to the Social Justice Committee meeting, or the Humanist Group.